Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The Honolulu Rail Project turns a corner. Construction of the third leg deep into the urban core will rest with the company Tutor Perini. We hear more about the award and what to expect from HART CEO Lori Kaikina. On and then off, we're talking about electricity disconnection cases, why the Hawaii Public Utilities Commission wants to hear from you. We learn about coping with the stress of temporary housing as we navigate this latest phase of recovery from the Maui wildfires. And it is the grand finale for Maui's Ebb and Flow Arts musical concerts, why the 25th anniversary event will be its last in the islands. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a week since HART, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, awarded the construction contract for the third leg of the Skyline Guideway and stations to Tutor Perini. The California Rail Company has built rail systems across both the east and west coast of the U.S. The $1.66 billion award is a milestone for Honolulu's rail system. It takes the route from Middle Street to Kaka'ako City Center, a few blocks from Honolulu Hale. We talked to HART CEO Lori Kaikina yesterday, who was tasked with building the nearly $10 million system.
We are on schedule to give them notice to proceed mid-September. There's some paperwork that they have to get together for us, but they're actually anxious and ready to go. So hopefully mid-September, we can give them that notice to proceed. They will be moving into our offices. That was one way that we could drill down some of their costs by having them move in here and be embedded within us with our team. We did that with a couple of our other contractors, Coluccio, and it seems to work out really well when the contractor is embedded with us. We have the designers, we have the HART team all working collaboratively together.
And then this unlocks then money from the feds.
Yeah, sure. That's correct. Thank you for bringing that up. So, you know, we got about half of the funding, the $1.55 billion grant from FTA. And back in 2017, they stopped giving us funds. So we only received about half. And then when we did the recovery plan and then subsequent to that, the acceptance or approval of the full funding grant agreement amendment, that released the first tranche that we haven't seen in about 7 years. So the second tranche that is due to us is $250 million. So in the recovery plan, there are milestones. Once we reach those milestones, that's the release of the tranche. So 125 was the first one for amending that full funding grant agreement, and then 250 for awarding the City Center Guideway Station contract. But just to remind your listeners, it's not like a big check that they write to us. It's the opportunity to receive the funds. So now we have to put in an application for this extra $250 million, and then we submit invoices to them that they need to review, approve, and reimburse us. So all our bills are paid up front and they reimburse us.
And then this pot of money is going to pay the leg that's underway now. Is that correct?
Actually, a little bit of probably segment two, but majority it will be segment three. Because right now, we do have funds sitting in a bank account with BFS, the City and County Budget and Fiscal Services. So we do have cash in the account right now because, like I said, as the GETTET comes in, we submit invoices to the state, they audit every invoice, and then they reimburse us. So those funds are sitting in an account right now. But when the $250 million, it's going to be the opportunity to ask for reimbursement from the FTA. So once we have the invoices from Tutor Perini, that will go to FTA to come in. So it's kind of hard to say that, oh, every penny from this is going to go to segment two or segment three. It's a pot of money that as our invoices come in, gets reimbursed.
A line of credit, exactly. Then, is how this will work. They will get into, then, the design of this last leg. And I know it's probably a bit trickier just because of the utilities and, you know, squeezing through the urban core there.
So the utilities will be complete by the time they are ready to go. So that's the Coluccio and the non-contracts. So Coluccio is doing downtown and Non is doing Dillingham. So the utilities will be cleared out of the way, and then Tudor is actually assuming that they'll have shoveled to ground next year. So that was actually sooner than I anticipated because it is a design build. I thought they would take about a full year, maybe a year and a half, to complete their designs and then shovel to ground the following year. But they want to move, and they feel that, no, we can start digging up next year already. And I do not have a schedule from them yet. It is too preliminary, but they decide on how they're going to work, which direction. It would probably make more sense to come from the Halekuwila and work backwards because Non is still going to be doing utility relocation, but it's really up to them. We don't dictate how they're going to do it. So as I give presentations for, especially when I talk about Dillingham, there's no left turns now, except for the big intersections like at Alakava, but they're never coming back. People need to get used to that. Just like on the west side, you have the columns that are going down the center, and there's going to be a medial strip in the center, so you will never be able to turn left into driveways. So the same thing that's going to happen down at, so the, where the construction is going on right now on Dillingham and Halekuwila, that's going to continue for several more years. So even if the utility is done, Tudor Perini is coming in right after that. But I suspect that their work will be more linear as compared to the utilities. Like Dillingham is completely a construction zone all the way down, but Tudor Perini might be more linear because they're going to put in the columns, they're going to put up the guideway, and then work progressively down that way.
Okay, but this whole no left turn thing, I mean, that's a biggie. People need to process that. No more left turns.
People need to So we did work with Google and Apple to, if people are going to put in their destination in those apps, it will lead them on how to get around and so that they turn right into driveways. So yes, it is it's a life changer, and it's not coming back.
The other thing, when we last talked, you had mentioned when the second segment from the stadium gets going that you may have to shut down service to the first leg. So is that still the plan? And do we know more information about that? You know, will it be just short inconveniences, or are we talking days?
Good question. We are still, the plan isn't set yet. We are still in coordination with DTS and Hitachi. As we start getting closer, last update I heard that it was going to be 4 weekends to do the shutdown. So hopefully we don't have major impact on the commuters during the weekday as they need to go to school and work. The plan as of today is to shut down over the weekend, but that could change. DTS has a huge say in how we do this. They might say, just get it done, 2 full weeks, shut down the 2 full weeks and get this thing going. So nothing has been set in concrete as of today.
Okay, but that is something that should be on the radar of our users because, you know, we're getting them into this routine of jumping on rail and on the bus. And then for a few days, we are going to have no service.
Correct. So DTS will put in bus bridges to have a minimal, less impact on the riders for the duration that we're going to be down. But that's why huge thing that we have to make sure we coordinate very closely with DTS and Hitachi to make sure that everything is done correctly.
How far out are we talking about this?
So we are planning on handing this over to DTS before the end of next year. So in order, all the testing, we're going to continue to do the testing. They are making good progress. I want to say Hitachi is about overall, maybe about 60 to 70% complete on their testing. And then just like the first segment, we're going to have to do the testing scenarios, the trial running. And then once that has passed everything, then we call it a cutover where, okay, now we're going to Segment two is doing fine. It's working. Segment one is working fine. Shut down and then bring the two of them up together. And that's where you're going to see where the segment one shutdown, whether it's going to be over the 4 weekends or 2 weeks, it just depends what DTS wants us to do. But that will be done right before we're ready to hand this over to DTS. So we're talking more like the end of next year.
Okay.
When this will happen.
All right. But still, you know, nobody likes surprises. And so we just have to be able to plan for this.
Yes. Correct. Get the message out. Talk to all of you folks, all the media, to help get the information out on so people are not surprised. Well, I'm sure Hitachi and DTS will be putting out notices at the stations. They have their ambassadors there to get the information out that, hey, don't forget, next week, this is what's going to happen. So, yes, we will definitely make a push for that.
I imagine the same thing will happen once this other leg gets going and is up and running. You'll have to shut down the entire service.
We'll have to, yes, segments one and two, bring them down and then bring up one, two, and three together.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to add about this final segment?
I'm hoping that it's less intrusive as the utility relocations. As I mentioned, it'll be more linear. So hopefully there'll be a little bit more relief for the commuters and the businesses down there. But, you know, one thing I do want to share, we had our all hands meeting. We meet monthly with all of our staff. We bring them all together in a room, and I just wanted to congratulate them and thank them, because this is either the third or fourth time that HART has been trying to award this part of the project. And to get it successfully awarded, it's a huge milestone for the team. And some of them have been through the previous attempts. So this is a very momentous moment for them. So I just wanted to put that out there and just thank them. And they did a terrific job getting this done.
That was Lori Kaikina, HART CEO, talking to us about next steps as a major contract for the third leg of Honolulu Skyline Train has just been awarded to Tutor Perini Corporation. Kaikina says as the roads get torn up to deal with utilities in the urban core, she does worry about construction on the leg along Halikawila. It's an area where there were known burial sites and where the discovery of Evie or bones halted the rail project back in the beginning. Remember that? We do plan to hear from the city's transportation officials next week about the expected disruption of service when testing of the second leg of the tracks begins later next year.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Vice presidential candidates Tim Walz and J.D. Vance are both hyping their Midwestern identities.
We're white guys from the Midwest. I guess there are similarities there. But what's different is the actual ideas about how best to serve people, white, black, or anything else, in the Midwest and everywhere else.
I'm Tiziana Deering. Midwestern identity in politics today. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
About a year and a half, Hawaii's utility companies were not allowed to disconnect service to customers who fell behind on their bills during the pandemic. Well, that's changed now, and the trend nationwide in some places is almost double pre-pandemic levels. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us to talk about this trend. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so double pre-pandemic levels, that's happening here, right?
Yes, we're seeing high numbers of utility disconnections. So people who are unable to pay their bills are having their power cut off at levels that are about twice as high as what we saw between 2017 and 2019 before we had a moratorium in place during the pandemic in which no one was having their power cut off. And so the Public Utilities Commission wants to know more about what's happening with utility disconnections in our islands. They've opened up a conversation as part of their energy docket, and they're inviting the public to come share their experience. They have this big report that they've commissioned from RMI, and it looks at both the different statistics we have for where utility disconnections are taking place across our couple of counties, as well as reforms that other places, other states, and even other countries have implemented to try to make sure that people aren't having their power cut off unnecessarily.
Yeah, and I did jump on that website yesterday. It's really interesting because it just maps out where, you know, what the trends are state by state.
Absolutely. So the Energy Justice Lab is heavily cited in that report, and they are really looking to try to get more data on where disconnections are taking place. COVID-19 was the first time in many states there was a reporting requirement for utilities to say how many people that they were disconnecting. And they're also trying to fill in some of the blanks as to why people are getting caught their power cut off at higher rates. So some of the factors will be kind of intuitive to our listeners, I'm sure. You know, energy bills in Hawaii are really, really expensive. The latest data from the Energy Information Administration shows that Hawaii, once again, has the highest electricity rates in the country. And it's not just energy. You know, everything in Hawaii is expensive, and that puts a lot of pressure on people. The poverty rate in Hawaii has jumped from 8% in 2018 to 15% in 2020. And not only did we have that moratorium in place on utility disconnections, so people couldn't have their electricity or gas shut off if they couldn't pay their bills, we also had far more funding for programs that provided utility and rental assistance. And a lot of those have kind of wound down in the years since we were in the deep midst of the pandemic.
Well, the city has something going on right now, though, if I recall.
Yes. So actually, on this Friday, the city of Honolulu, the city and county of Honolulu, in partnership with the Council of Native Hawaiian Advancement, as well as Catholic Charities Hawaii, is offering an event. They have taken applications for people who need rental or utility assistance. Those folks have to appear for in-person appointments in Makiki. They said, when I called, they said all those slots are full, but they can possibly accept walk-ins if there's a no-show for an appointment, so folks can go to Makiki and try to get assistance there. And when I spoke on the phone with folks from the Council of Native Hawaiian Advancement, and also I confirmed this with the city and county, they say that whether or not they're able to offer this type of program again really depends on how much funding is left over from this event. So that's another program where we're seeing it possibly kind of wind down and not have the same assistance for folks that we might have seen in the pandemic 2 years ago.
Well, you know, I know just on my street we had a neighbor who got a disconnect notice, and in that situation, you know, there was an adult with disabilities, and the parent got sick and died, and so, you know, the poor neighbor didn't have the wherewithal to deal with bills, and so, you know, there are stories behind why people are not paying their bills.
Absolutely, and the Public Utilities Commission wants those stories. I spoke with Mike Walderstein. He's an attorney with the Public Utilities Commission just before we jumped on the line, Catherine, and he said, we really want to know the who, what, when, where, why of people's experiences with utility disconnections. They're inviting people to read through the report that they submitted with all these different reforms and provide public comment by September 16th. They're then hoping to host another open forum in October and start doing more data collection on utility disconnections in the islands. That report has a lot of different reforms that people can look at. Like the most extreme reform, and there's only one county or one utility that I'm aware of in the country that's done this, Los Angeles utility, which provides both water and power, and it's a government-run utility, has just decided no longer to disconnect people who don't pay. But there are a bunch of kind of interim measures that the state could explore. So making sure that people are contacted in person or over the phone rather than just getting something in the mail, or extending the amount of time before people can have that people have to pay their bills back before their power is shut off, or considering something that we don't have in Hawaii but that is more common on the continent is if there's adverse weather, you know, here in Hawaii, if it gets really, really hot, putting a moratorium in place to make sure that people will have access to AC and can stay comfortable and healthy in those situations.
Okay, but the PUC does want to hear from folks, so they should know that now's the time.
Absolutely.
All right, well, thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read her energy and climate change stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Jim and Andrea Harris on Maui, station members and fans for more than 15 years, in appreciation for HPR's programming.
On the next Fresh Air, how one investigative reporter says Donald Trump has changed federal law enforcement. David Rode argues that since 2016, Trump has used conspiracy theories, co-option, and threats to bend Justice Department and FBI officials to his will, where tyranny begins. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, performing classical works and pieces from the Pacific region at Hawaii Theater and the Tom Moffat Waikiki Shell. Full schedule and subscriptions at myhso.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Calling all Pokemon trainers, we choose you to answer this backyard quiz. The 2024 Pokemon World Championships was just held here last weekend. It was held at the Hawaii Convention Center. With the event came many festivities that both residents and visitors could participate in. There was a pop-up Pokemon Center where participants could buy merchandise, including event-exclusive swag and Pokemon plush toys. At the Hilton Hawaiian Village, there were free events featuring Pokemon mascots and cosplayers. A drone show even lit up the skies of Waikiki on Sunday night with images of the iconic Pokemon, including Pikachu riding a manta ray. Unfortunately, today's special Pokemon wasn't featured in this light show, but we'd still like you to catch them when you can. Our special backyard quiz today, what is the name of Hawaii's regional Pokemon? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, this week we got a snapshot on the status of temporary modular housing being built on Maui, hundreds of units that will house fire survivors for the next several years. But these projects may only offer a temporary solution to a deeper psychological problem. The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently spoke with Diego Guerrera, team lead and crisis counselor from Malu'i Ka'ulu, the Hawaii Resiliency Project. Guerrera and some 23 other employees staff a crisis hotline, as well as a warm line in Maui, where residents can call in with fond memories of the places that they once call home.
We are paid through, it's a government grant, through FEMA and SAMHSA. They contract local mental health, behavioral health organizations to create a crisis counseling program. This was done back in 2018 here during COVID and is done across our whole country whenever there's a really devastating event that happens.
So did you already kind of have the infrastructure in place to like do crisis counseling from the previous times?
Sort of. We had a sort of basic idea, but I think what made this so unique was one, being back in person versus COVID and sort of trying to be out in the community. And the other aspect being that the community was lost. And so how do you approach Lahaina and upcountry when those kind of community spaces that people would gather around or be at, or even their homes, are no longer there? And so that created a unique challenge for us to try and reach people. One of the ways that we did that was actually by going to the different hotels where the temporary housing where people were at and setting up a table downstairs in the lobby where people were coming through, as well as going door to door and kind of checking on people.
What are the ways in which some of their concerns have either changed since a year ago or stayed the same? Like, what keeps coming up now?
What sort of stayed the same is that unmet need of housing. And even with this interim housing where people are placed, it's still not their homes that they've lost. And that is sort of a level of discomfort that can affect people in a really significant way. Our homes are usually kind of what we come back to as a safe space, and to not feel comfortable would be very difficult for anyone. So when the community is trying to move forward and they don't know what their housing situation is going to be down the line in the future, tomorrow can seem like a big deal. And they're not able to plan for the future. And so not having a safe space to relax and rest can kind of lead to a decline in mental health. And so what we, Malu'i Ka'ulu, tried to do is to kind of combat some of these mental health challenges by helping people develop thoughts and behaviors and different ways of coping to establish a sense of normalcy and control in their lives.
It seems like people at this point know they're secure for the next year, perhaps, or if they're moving into some of these units, they might be secure for the next up to 5 years. But there is this mid to long term concern of what does the future look like? So how would you address those concerns with that type of person?
I think with that type of person, we run into a lot, and there's not like a one size fits all approach. Every person is unique, and trying to find what works for that person is what we stay around as a strategy to cope with these kind of psychological impacts. I try to kind of see like what people liked to do in the past. What were their usual methods of self-care before they came into this new housing? And so was it going to the beach? Was it going on walks? Was it spending more time with someone? And if those kind of usual suspects aren't working, what are some new strategies that can be developed to cope in different ways? And I think one of the most significant impacts that we've seen from this kind of interim housing situation is even with housing, this loss of the Lahaina community and the social interactions that were within the community is hard. Missing out on these everyday interactions that made Lahaina what it is in stores and restaurants and on the street, these small moments have very big impacts on lives. And so when someone's placed in an unfamiliar environment, upcountry, Kahului, just somewhere that wasn't their community, it can be isolating and can have a negative effect on our mental health. And so we try to reestablish a sense of community through small actionable steps to rebuild that sense of belonging. At Maluikuʻulu, even having our warm line for people just to call in and tell us their stories, that can allow them to reminisce and connect to their past, which allows them to have that connection, however disconnected it may feel.
Are you busier than you were a year ago? Were you super busy at first? And is it now maybe not as many people are seeking comfort and care?
There's been more people kind of seeking help in the past few months that I've noticed, especially with trying to get a therapist and trying to look out for mental health, whether theirs or their families. It was steady throughout the past year, but I think in the past few months, when especially there's been a lot more triggers and people are getting placed and feeling a little bit more secure where they are, it allows them to kind of tap into that mental health and check in with themselves. You know, when you're just kind of going and going and you don't have the time to stop and kind of reflect, it can seem like you're fine. And so people, I believe, are starting to stop and reflect and kind of see that, oh, maybe we aren't so fine. Just a few days ago, we had a few incidents that, you know, people were evacuated from upcountry. There was some really scary moments that were significant. There's like police presence, but then there's also smaller things like they were testing the air raid sirens a few days before school in Lahaina, and a few fire trucks ran up Lahaina Luna Road. And so what we try to remind people at Maluikuʻulu is that these kind of reactions are completely common and natural, especially having gone through such a like significant event, and to not shut them down and shut yourself down when these happen, but to just kind of work through them and allow them to dissipate, and that they will get easier over time. And so even if it is trying to satisfy that immediate worry, that is maybe having a fire extinguisher, to also keep in mind that, you know, no amount of fire extinguishers is going to make some of these feelings go away. And so to kind of be kind to yourself and reach out to other people when you are remembering these feelings and when your body is remembering these feelings. I mean, trauma is stored in very different ways. And so while we may not remember it, our bodies do. And so, you know, to think our way out of some of these things can be counterproductive. And so to instead kind of have someone there with you is some of the best medicine you can have. I've worked with grandmothers who, you know, are worried about making an impact on their grandchildren. I've worked with kids who are still trying to be kids after this event. And sort of that common line you see is that resiliency that's innate within all of us, the ability to sort of bounce back after hard times like this and to learn, grow. And so the approach and the understanding that I have is that I'm just here to remind people of that.
That was Diego Guerrero from the Crisis Counseling Project, Maluikuʻulu. Funding for the programming will end at the end of this year, but Guerrero says there will be other mental health initiatives and counseling for the midterm and the long term.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in a variety of ways, including exhibition openings and events at honolulumuseum.org.
Hey, remember the bad old days?
You know, the longer that rise in inflation went on, the more people were starting to call that it wasn't transitory anymore.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a walk down that particular economic memory lane. Next time on Marketplace.
beginning this evening at 6 following All Things Considered.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Now for this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a flashy native bird that calls Maui home.
Akoekoe are the largest honey creepers remaining in Maui Nui and are just a spectacular bird. Measuring about 7 inches from bill to tail, they're mostly shiny black, but their feathers are tipped in orange, silver, and white to give them a beautiful speckled appearance. They also have bright orange necks and a very unusual fluffy white crest on their forehead, which is where their English name, crested honeycreeper, comes from. Why they have this crest, no one really knows. One possibility is it helps attract the opposite sex, but another more likely possibility is it makes them better at dispersing pollen between the many flowers they visit throughout the day. This is important because akoekoe are nectarivores, meaning that nectar from a variety of native flowers is their main food source, though they spend most of their time sipping nectar from ohia lehua trees. Other nectarivores that compete for food with akoekoe include the orange-red iiwi and the brick-red apapane. Being the biggest of the three, akoekoe are able to chase away the others from their favored foraging areas. Like many other Hawaiian birds, the name akoekoe may come from some of the many sounds that they make. If you use your imagination, sound a little bit like their name. Akoekoe once ranged throughout Maui and Molokai, but today are only found in a relatively small patch of wet forest high up on the side of Haleakala volcano. With less than 2,000 birds left, they're considered to be critically endangered and are a major focus of conservation efforts from a variety of groups, including the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. Like most of our remaining honeycreepers, akoekoe are very susceptible to mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. And one recent study that used radio transmitters to track the movements of adults and juveniles found that while adults rarely leave the safety of their mosquito-free territories at high elevations, the juveniles travel widely across the landscape, including lower elevation forests that may have plenty of nectar resources, but also have disease-carrying mosquitoes. This, plus the fact that akoekoe only have one or two babies per year, is a major reason why their populations continue to decline, despite there being plenty of forest left on Maui for them to live. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah, providing tile, mosaic murals, and planters for 30 years. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about HydroFlow permeable pavers designed to absorb rainwater and reduce runoff.
Now it's time to catch the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we talked about the Pokemon World Championships that were hosted this past weekend in Waikiki. Did you catch all the Pokemon you wanted? Well, the last time Hawaii hosted the event was in 2012 at Waikoloa Village. The Pokemon franchise's love for Hawaii isn't limited to just their venues and merch. It can be seen in their games, too. In the game Pokemon Go, today's special Pokemon can only be caught in Hawaii. In 2016, the game Sun and Moon was released, and it is set in the fictional region of Alola, which is loosely based on Hawaii. It was that game that introduced the Pokemon Comfy, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. This fairy-type Pokemon has the appearance of a lei decorated with many vibrant flowers. It uses a vine to pick the flowers, and when they become attached to Comfy, they develop healing properties. And congrats to our winner today, Rachel Clark from Kailua. You got it. And that is our quiz. If you'd like to share one, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, the music nonprofit Ebb and Flow Arts is all about change. And with that in mind, this Friday's Ebb and Flow Arts Concert on Maui marks its 25th anniversary. And it will also be its last event in Hawaii. Heading the free concert is pianist Alexander Dosin, who was inspired by a performance by Ebb and Flow Arts founder Robert Pollock. Here's a clip from the compilation album 20 Years of Ebb and Flow Arts. It features Pollock on piano playing Page from a Diary. You know, we talked to Pollock and Dosin yesterday afternoon. Pollock starts us off by explaining why the Friday concert will be its final one in the islands.
Ebb and Flow Arts has been around 25 years. We've had an impact. We've had 165 concerts, 1,300 music lessons in the elementary schools here on Maui, the public elementary schools, approximately 600 works by 180 composers produced. We presented in all four counties of Hawaii, as well as off-island, Japan, Korea, New York City, Chicago, Mexico, California, and many, many radio broadcasts, including this one. Specifically on HPR, we've broadcast concerts that were live at Atherton and then live-streamed out to the public.
Well, you've had lots to be proud of as you reflect back.
It is, and it's kind of always for me a miraculous achievement being out here in Hawaii to bring performers as so gifted and talented as Alexandra out to Hawaii and then have, as we have, particularly pre-pandemic, wonderful turnouts here on Maui and the other islands for modern music. It's been very, very gratifying, and we are proud of that achievement. As one of our board members said, it's better to leave on a high note, so to speak,
okay.
Not to mix metaphors, but, you know, it's better to leave in a successful mode, still going strong in a sense, but also realizing that it's too taxing on me at this point. And I've noticed over the last couple of years, things haven't gone as well. And it's not necessarily my fault in a way, but post-pandemic, I got so jaded with these full houses, standing room only, and post-pandemic, not so much. You really had to struggle out. Initially, we had to be very careful and mindful of the COVID, and the first concerts were extremely limited in the distance between audience and performer, the distance between audience member and the person sitting next to them.
Yes, very challenging.
So anyway, I feel like we've made modern music a part of the musical landscape in Hawaii, that as one of our board members said, whenever he hears atonal music, he thinks of Ebb and Flow Arts.
Nice.
So I assume that's a compliment.
Well,
anyway.
Alex, jump in here because, you know, no pressure, but this is the finale, right?
I know. You know, Robert says he wants to end on a high note. So, again, no pressure. I feel really fortunate. The way I actually met Robert was very special because I heard his performance of George Walker's Piano Sonata No. 5, which was my first experience with George Walker's piano music. And that made such a mark on me that in less than 48 hours after listening to that recording, I managed to have a contract with Naxos to record the complete piano works. And that never happened before with me. I mean, I never made decisions so fast in terms of repertoire and all that. But George Walker was something different for me. So that was the first time that Robert and I kind of got connected through George Walker.
Let me interject for a minute because Catherine may not be familiar. George Walker is the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize in music. And I got to know him in New Jersey when we ran the Composers Guild of New Jersey. He was a New Jersey resident. We became quite good friends. And then finally out here, we brought him, George, out probably about 15 years ago for a celebration of his music, both on Maui and in Honolulu at Atherton, where we had a kind of marathon concert of his works and others. And so this connection, as Alexandra said, is that we're fellow Walkerians and in the sense that we both admire and revere, really, the work of this great American composer. So it was wonderful to, out of the blue, really, to hear from Alexandra about his devotion and immediately realize this is someone we should have out here to perform. And again, it's very fitting that this final concert would be in part featuring this work of George Walker, who served as our honorary president until his passing in 2018.
And so tell us, what other works do you plan to include in this, Alex?
So I decided to do sort of autobiographical recital in a way that there are three countries that are very important for me. Brazil, where I was born, and Russia, where I studied for 9 years, and the U.S., where I'm a citizen and have been residing in the U.S. for almost 30 years now. So I decided to explore repertoire from these three countries, and I will do in the order that they happened in my life. So I will start the recital with one of my favorite piano works by Heitor Villa-Lobos, the Baquianas Brasileiras No. 4. Then, as I went to Russia when I was 18 to study at the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatory, I will follow with some Russian music, and I decided to include some of the pieces that are going to be my next Naxos CD, piano music by Prokofiev. And that group of pieces is very interesting in the sense that none of them were written for solo piano. I will be performing all transcriptions by Sergei Prokofiev of his own pieces. So it's going to be a movement from a symphony, a couple of selections from an opera, and also some selections from ballet. But those are all originally arranged for piano by Prokofiev. Then I follow with the U.S., and I will do a group of pieces by George Walker and the recital, hopefully on a high note, with the great classic of American music, The Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin.
Sounds like a wonderful lineup, but again, you know, I guess your fans need to know that this will be the final concert then as we mark 25 years.
Yeah. Yes, we're hoping for a very good turnout because of that.
And then talk about what you plan to do. You're going to focus on your music?
Yes. I'm a composer and have a couple of commissions right now and still have some performances left in me as a pianist, particularly of my own music. So that's going to be my focus in the future. And by the way, there's going to be a 6 p.m. pre-concert discussion before the 7 p.m. concert. This event, as most of our events, It will be free admission. Donations accepted, of course, but there is no admission charge. And it's a good idea to get there early to the church. This is at the Keawalai Congregational Church in McKenna. It's a beautiful Hawaiian church, wonderful setting, very good acoustic, very bright, and a good piano. So it's has been our venue of choice for the last three or four events. The phone number, in case anyone's interested, 808-876-1854. Or our website, ebbandflowarts.org.
And we've been hearing from Robert Pollock of Ebb and Flow Arts. He was talking about the group's final Hawaii concert this Friday on Maui. It will begin with a pre-concert chat at 6 p.m. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today. We have to go now, but up tomorrow we plan to talk with the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation as it marks its 50th anniversary. Leave your feedback for us on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our shows as a podcast by searching for The Conversation on our website or on Apple, Google, or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.